Harder questions. What radical high-risk action needs to be considered? What do they need to stop doing? Where can they move resources or find new partners? By deadline, a healthy fraction of those impossible goals are somehow achieved in full. Let's discuss stretch variables. To succeed, a stretch goal cannot seem like a long march to nowhere, nor can it be imposed from on high without regard to realities on the ground. Stretch your team too fast and too far, and it may snap. So in pursuing high-effort, high-risk goals, employee commitment is essential. Leaders must convey two things: the importance of the outcome and the belief that it's attainable. Few entities have Google's resources to fall back upon when a moonshot crashes. Organizations have a range of risk tolerance, which may change over time. The greater the margin for error, the more a company can extend itself. For example, a 40% OKR failure rate might seem too risky and too discouraging, no matter what leadership says. For high achievers, anything shy of perfection can sap morale. At Risk Management Solutions in California, there are, quote, more degrees than employees, says Amelia Merrill, a former HR leader. The people here are used to getting A's. They don't get B's. Not getting 100%? That's just really hard culturally to make that transition. At MyFitnessPal, Mike Lee considers all OKRs to be committed goals. Difficult and demanding, yes, but attainable in full. I'm trying to set the bar right at what I think it should be, he says. If we get them all done, I'll feel good about our progress. That's a reasonable approach, but not without pitfalls. Will Mike's people shy away from objectives where they might top out at 90%? In my view, it's better for leaders to set at least a modest stretch. Over time, as teams and individuals gain experience with OKRs, their key results will become more precise and more aggressive. So there is no one magic number for the right stretch, but consider this. How can your team create maximum value? What would amazing look like? If you seek to achieve greatness, stretching for amazing is a great way to start. But by no means, as Andy Grove made clear, is it the place to stop. He said,
"You know, in our business, we have to set ourselves uncomfortably tough objectives, and then we have to meet them. And then, after 10 milliseconds of celebration, we have to set ourselves another set of highly difficult-to-reach objectives, and we have to meet them. And the reward of having met one of these challenging goals is that you get to play again."
Chapter 13. Stretch. The Google Chrome Story. With Sundar Pichai, CEO of Google. A few years back, stretch goals were beautifully defined by the leader of the Google X team that developed the Loon balloons and self-driving cars. Said Astro Teller, quote, "If you want your car to get 50 miles per gallon, fine. You can retool your car a little bit. But if I tell you it has to run on a gallon of gas for 500 miles, you have to start over." In 2008, Sundar Pichai was Google's vice president of product development. When Sundar and his team took their Chrome browser to market, they were mostly definitely starting over. Driven to succeed but unafraid of failure, they used OKRs to catapult their product and their company to amazing. Chrome is now the most popular web browser by far on both the mobile and desktop platforms. But as you will see, there were bumps in the road. As Larry Page says, if you set a crazy ambitious goal and miss it, you'll still achieve something remarkable. When you aim for the stars, you may come up short, but still reach the moon. The career of Sundar Pichai is a stretch goal personified. In October 2015, at the age of 43, Sundar became Google's third CEO. Today, he presides over an organization with more than 60,000 employees and $80 billion in revenues. Here's Sundar Pichai.
Sundar Pichai. Growing up in South India in the 1980s, I had scant exposure to technology as we see it today. yet what we had made a profound impact on my life. My father was an electrical engineer in Chennai, a great metropolis, but we lived modestly. The waiting list for a telephone, a rotary dial model, was 3 to 4 years. I was 12 years old when my family finally got one. It was a big event. Neighbors would come and use it. I remember my life as pre-phone and post-phone. That one device changed so many things. Pre-phone, my mother would say, "Can you see if the blood test is ready in the hospital?" I would catch a bus and ride to the hospital and wait in line, and often they would tell me, "No, it isn't ready yet. Come tomorrow." By the time I rode the bus home, it was a 3-hour trip. Post-phone, I could simply call the hospital and know the results. Now we take technology for granted, and it gets better every day. But for me, there were these discrete moments, before and after, that I will never forget. I read every book about computers and semiconductors that I could lay my hands on. I aspired to somehow make it to Silicon Valley, which meant getting into Stanford. That was my goal, to be a part of all the change happening there. In a way, I think I dreamt even more fervently because so little technology was available to us. I was driven by the power of imagining. The new applications platform. For 5 years, I worked at Applied Materials in Santa Clara, in process engineering, R&D. Sometimes I would need to go to Intel, and I could feel the Andy Grove culture as soon as I stepped inside the door. The company was very disciplined, down to the smallest thing. I vaguely remember having paid for each cup of coffee. In semiconductor process engineering, you must be highly methodical in setting your goals and working your way through them. So my work at Applied Materials helped me think about goals in a more precise way. As the Internet continued to develop, I could see its tremendous potential. I read about everything Google was doing. I was passionate on the subject. I was especially excited when they launched a product called Deskbar, where you could search the web from Windows without opening the browser. It launched from a small window in the taskbar. It was there when you needed it, but only then. Deskbar was an early tool for growth, a way to bring Google to many more people. I joined Google as a product manager in 2004, when the company still revolved around search. But that was also the year of Web 2.0 and the rise of user-generated content and Ajax, a module of web development techniques that enabled users to communicate with a server without reloading a page or refreshing the browser. The early web was a content platform, but it was fast becoming an applications platform. We were seeing the beginning of a paradigm shift on the Internet, and I sensed that Google would be at the heart of it. My first assignment was to expand the use and distribution of Google Toolbar, which could be added to any browser to get you to Google search. It was the right project for the right time. In just a few years, we scaled up Toolbar users by more than 10 times. That was when I first saw the power of an ambitious stretch OKR. Rethinking the browser. By then, we'd set up something new for Google, a team to build client software. We had people working on Firefox to help improve Mozilla's browser. By 2006, we were beginning to rethink the browser as a computing platform, almost like an operating system, so that people could write applications on the web itself. That fundamental insight gave birth to Chrome. We knew we needed a multi-process architecture to make each tab its own process and to protect a user's Gmail if another application crashed. And we knew we had to get JavaScript working a lot faster. But we were up for the task of building the best browser possible. Eric Schmidt, our CEO, knew how hard it was to construct a browser from scratch. If you're doing it, you had better be serious about it. If Chrome wasn't going to be dramatically different and better and faster than the traditional browsers already on the market, there was no point in moving ahead. In 2008, the year of Chrome's rollout, our product management team formulated a top-level annual objective that would have an enduring influence on Google's future: to develop the next-generation client platform for web applications. The main key result: Chrome reaches 20 million 7-day active users. Upping the goal. In Google's OKR climate, it was understood that 70% achievement, on average, was considered a success. You weren't supposed to strive for greens on every OKR you wrote. That wouldn't stretch the team. But there was an intrinsic tension, because you didn't get hired at Google unless you were driven to succeed. As a leader, you didn't want to find yourself at the end of the quarter, standing in front of the company with a big red on the screen, having to explain why and how you failed. The pressure and discomfort of that experience made a lot of us do a lot of heroic things to avoid it. But if you set your team's objectives correctly, it was sometimes unavoidable. Larry was always good about upping the goals for the company OKRs. He used certain phrases that stuck with me. He wanted people at Google to be uncomfortably excited. He wanted us to have a healthy disregard for the impossible. I tried to do the same for the products team. It took courage to write an OKR that might well fail, but there was no other way if we wanted to be great. We deliberately set the bar for 20 million active users by year's end, knowing it was a formidable stretch. We were starting from zero, after all. As a leader, you must try to challenge the team without making them feel the goal is unachievable. I thought it unlikely we would reach our target in time. Candidly, I thought there was no way we would get there. But I also considered it important to keep pushing to the limit of our ability and beyond. Our stretch OKR gave the team direction and a barometer to measure our progress. It made complacency impossible. And it kept us all rethinking, every day, the framework for what we were doing. All of these things were more important than reaching a somewhat arbitrary target on a designated day. Early on, as Chrome struggled to reach 3% market share, we received some unanticipated bad news. The Mac version of Chrome fell way behind schedule. Only Windows users would count toward the 20 million. But there was good news too. People who used Chrome loved it, which was starting to have a compounding effect on growth. Glitches notwithstanding, we were driving awareness of a new way to engage the web. Digging deeper. Google stands for speed. The company has waged a constant battle against latency, the delay in a data transfer that degrades the user experience. In 2008, Larry and Sergey wrote a beautiful OKR that truly captured people's attention. We should make the web as fast as flipping through a magazine. It inspired the whole company to think harder about how we could make things better and faster. For the Chrome project, we created a sub-OKR to turbocharge JavaScript. The goal was to make applications on the web work as smoothly as downloads on a desktop. We set a moonshot goal of 10 times improvement and named the project V8, after the high-performance car engine. We were fortunate to find a Danish programmer named Lars Back, who'd built virtual machines for Sun Microsystems and held more than a dozen patents. Lars is one of the great artists in his field. he came to us and said, without an ounce of bravado, I can do something that is much, much faster. Within 4 months, he had JavaScript running 10 times as fast as it ran on Firefox. Within 2 years, it was more than 20 times faster. Incredible progress. Sometimes a stretch goal is not as wildly aspirational as it may seem. As Lars later told Stephen Levy in the Plex, we sort of underestimated what we could do. Stretch OKRs are an intense exercise in problem solving. Having gone through the toolbar journey, I had a good sense of how to work my way through the inevitable troughs. I stayed cautiously optimistic with my team. If we were losing users, I would tell them, let's do an experiment to understand why and fix it. If compatibility was an issue, I'd assign a group to focus on that. I tried to be thoughtful and systematic and not too emotional, and I think that helped. Google is propelled by our moonshot culture. The very ambitious is very hard to do. In a healthy way, our team realized that the success of Chrome would ultimately mean hundreds of millions of users. Whenever we invent something new at Google, we're always thinking, how can we scale it to a billion? Early in the process, that number can seem very abstract. But when you set a measurable objective for the year and chunk the problem, quarter by quarter, moonshots become more doable. That's one of the great benefits of OKRs. They give us clear quantitative targets on the road to those qualitative leaps. After we failed against the 20 million in 2008, it made us dig deeper. We never gave up on the objective, but we changed the way we framed it. Here's what I tried to communicate. No, we didn't reach the goal, but we are laying the foundation to break through this barrier. Now, what are we going to do differently? In a culture of smart people, you had better have good answers to that question. You can't tap dance your way through. In this case, we needed a solution to one very basic problem. Why was it so difficult to get people to try a new browser? That's how we became motivated to find new distribution deals for Chrome. Down the road, when we found that people were unclear about just what a browser did for them, we turned to television marketing to explain it. Our Chrome ads represented the largest offline campaign in the company's history. People still remember Dear Sophie, a spot created around a father's digital scrapbook of his daughter as she grew. It showed the easy entree from our browser to such a rich stock of web-based applications, from Gmail and YouTube to Google Maps. It led people to the internet as an applications platform. Try, fail, try, succeed. Success was not instantaneous. In 2009, we set another stretch OKR for Chrome. 50 million 7-day active users, and failed again, ending the year at 38 million. For 2010, undeterred, I proposed a target of 100 million users. Larry believed we should be pushing even harder. My target, he pointed out, touched only 10% of the world's 1 billion internet users at the time. I countered that 100 million was in fact very aggressive. Larry and I eventually settled on an OKR of 111 million users, a classic stretch goal. To reach it, we knew we'd need to reinvent the business of Chrome and think about growth in new ways. Again, what could we do differently? In February, we broadened our distribution deals with the OEMs, original equipment manufacturers. In March, we embarked on a Chrome-fast marketing campaign to heighten product awareness in the United States. In May, we expanded our demographic by launching Chrome for OS X and Linux. At last, our browser was no longer a Windows-only product. Well into the third quarter, the outcome remained in doubt. Weeks later, at the end of Q3, our user total had surged from 87 million to 107 million. And shortly after that, we reached 111 million 7-day actives. We had achieved our goal. Today, on mobile alone, there are more than 1 billion active users of Chrome. We couldn't have gotten there without objectives and key results. OKRs are the way we think about everything at Google, the way we've always done it. The next frontier. My father came of age in a time when computing meant huge teams and mainframes and system administrators, when computers were both inaccessible and very complicated. By the time I was working on Chrome, I realized that all he wanted was an easy, straightforward way to use the web. I've always been fascinated by simplicity. For all the complex things Google search could do, the user experience was phenomenally uncomplicated. I wanted to emulate that quality in our browser, to the point where you could be a kid in India or a professor at Stanford, and it wouldn't matter. If you had access to a computer and adequate connectivity, your experience with Chrome would be manifestly simple. I had the great good fortune of working on Chrome and even sharing an office with Linus Upson, who led the team's engineering group. At the end of the workday, I could never tell whether Linus had left or not, because his desk was always so clean. If one of his pens was lying at an angle, I knew something was wrong. Linus had a maniacal focus on simplicity. He gave us the cutting edge we needed to make Chrome the seamless experience it is today. In 2008, when my father was retired, I gave him a netbook and showed him how to use Chrome. And then, an amazing thing happened for him. The technology just faded away. He could just do whatever he wanted on the thriving applications platform on the web. Once he got into the browser, he never opened another app. He never downloaded another piece of software. He was immersed in a new and wonderfully simple world. At Google, from very early on, I internalized the need to constantly imagine the next frontier, from toolbar to Chrome, for example. You can never stop stretching. My father's experience got us thinking, what if we could design an operating system with comparable simplicity and security, with the Chrome browser as its user interface? And what if we could invent a laptop around that operating system, a Chromebook, to tap directly into all of those applications living in the cloud? But those would be stretch goals for another day.
Chapter 14. Stretch, the YouTube story. With Susan Wojcicki, the CEO, and Christos Goodrow, the Vice President of Engineering. Google is so teeming with stretch goals that it would feel incomplete to chronicle only one of them. And so here is a second, the behind-the-scenes story of YouTube and how it grew exponentially with the stretch OKR superpower. Susan Wojcicki, according to Time magazine, is the most powerful woman on the Internet. She's played a central role at Google from the start, even before becoming employee number 16 and the company's first marketing manager. In September 1998, days after Google was incorporated, Susan rented out her Menlo Park garage for the company's first office. 8 years later, as analysts doubted that YouTube would survive, she was a leading voice in persuading Google's board to acquire it. Susan had the vision to see that online video was about to disrupt network television forever. By 2012, YouTube had become a market leader and one of the biggest video platforms in the world. But its furious pace of innovation had slowed. and once you touch the brake, it's not so easy to re-accelerate. By that point, Susan had risen to Senior Vice President of Advertising and Commerce, where she reimagined AdWords and envisioned a new way to monetize the web with AdSense. In other words, she drove the success of Google's two main revenue streams. In 2014, as the new CEO of YouTube, she inherited one of the most aggressive goals anytime, anywhere. Over a span of 4 years, the mission was to reach 1 billion hours of people watching YouTube every day, to grow by a factor of 10. Susan and a veteran YouTube engineering leader, Christos Goudreau, had their work cut out for them, and they would rely on OKRs every step of the way. Stretch goals are invigorating. By committing to radical qualitative improvement, an established organization can renew its sense of urgency and reap tremendous dividends. YouTube's once struggling web video businesses scaled to more than 1 billion users, nearly a third of the total population on the internet. Its site can be navigated in more than 70 different languages in more than 80 countries, and its mobile platform alone reaches more 18 to 49-year-olds than any cable or broadcast network. None of this happened by accident or by the grace of a single insight. It took years of rigorous execution, meticulous attention to detail, and the structure and discipline of OKRs. And one more thing. Before YouTube could begin to chase its monumentally audacious objective, first it had to figure out how to measure what mattered.
When I leased my garage to Larry and Sergey, I had no interest in Google as a company. I just wanted them to pay the rent. But then I got to know them and how they thought about things. I had ideas for starting my own company, but it dawned on me that Larry and Sergey were better positioned to execute them. And then there was the day that Google search went down, and I couldn't get my work done. Google, I realized, had become an indispensable tool. I couldn't live without it, and I thought, this is going to be important for everyone. I was there when John Doerr came to talk to us about OKRs in the fall of 1999. By then, we'd outgrown my garage and moved to 2400 Bayshore in Mountain View, an old Sun Microsystems plant. The whole building might have been 42,000 square feet, and we operated in less than half of it. We had the OKR meeting in the other half, the part reserved for all hands. I can remember John explaining the concept. This is an objective. This is a key result. And using the football analogy to demonstrate how OKRs were implemented. The other day, sorting through some files, I came across John's presentation on plastic laminate sheets for an overhead projector. That's how old it was. Larry and Sergey were good at listening to people who knew what they were talking about. I'm sure they argued with John, but they listened. They had never run a company or even worked in a company before. John came in and said, "This is a way you can run your business, and it's measurable and trackable." Measurables were intuitive to Larry and Sergey, and they had to be impressed by the fact that Intel used OKRs. Intel was such a great company, and we were so small by comparison. Judging from our experience at Google, I'd say that OKRs are especially useful for young companies just starting to build their culture. When you're little, with fewer resources, it's even more vital to be clear on where you're going. It's like raising kids. If you bring them up with no structure, and then you tell them as teenagers, "Okay, now here are the rules," well, that's going to be hard. If possible, it's better to have rules from the start. At the same time, I've seen mature companies do turnarounds and change people and processes. No company is too young to adopt OKRs, and for no company is it too late. OKRs require organization. You need a leader to embrace the process and a lieutenant to ride herd over scoring and reviews. When I ran OKRs for Larry, I sat in on four-hour meetings with his leadership team where he'd debate all the company objectives and people were expected to be able to defend them and make sure they were clear. The guidance for OKRs at Google was often top-down, but with lots of discussion with experts on the team and significant give and take on key results. This is the direction we want to go. Now tell us how you're going to get there. Those long meetings enabled Larry to emphasize things he cared about and also to vent frustrations, especially around service on our product, OKRs. He'd say, tell me your speed now, and then, why can't you cut that in half? We still conduct our all-hands, top-level OKR meeting in a special video cast each quarter, though Google is now so large and multifaceted that it's hard to communicate everything we do to everyone. At one memorable all-hands, Saler Kamengard, my predecessor as YouTube CEO, did an amazing job running through the company's entire OKR roster. Saler can put anything into context. But in general, the more detailed discussions take place within our teams, and you'll still find OKRs posted on the company and team pages on Google's intranet, updated in real time, where any contributor can access and review them. If you can't, beat them. Google Video, our free video sharing website, launched in 2005, 1 month before YouTube. When I ran it, the first clip we uploaded for users was a purple Muppet singing a nonsense song. Sergey and I weren't sure what to make of it. But then my kid shouted, play it again! The light bulb went on. We saw a next generation opportunity, a new way for people to create video for global distribution. We went about building an interface and had our surprising first hit, two kids singing Backstreet Boys in their dorm room with a roommate studying in the background. We carried some professional videos too, but the user-generated content did better. The main flaw in Google Videos was a delay in our upload process. It broke a company rule for product development. Make it fast. User-uploaded videos weren't immediately available to watch, whereas on YouTube they were, a big problem. By the time we fixed it, we had lost significant market share. YouTube was outstreaming us 3-1, but financially they were struggling. Swamped by demand, they urgently needed capital to build infrastructure. It was clear they would have to sell. I saw an opportunity to combine the two services. I worked up some spreadsheets to justify the $1.65 billion purchase price to show that Google could make its money back and convince Larry and Sergey. At the last minute, the founders asked me to bring my spreadsheets to the board meeting. There were lots of questions. The board gave us the green light, though they weren't totally sold on my assumption for year-on-year user growth. And it's funny, because rapid growth is the one thing that YouTube has consistently delivered to this day.
Big rocks. In February 2011, when I came over from Google Product Search, 3 years before Susan joined the team, YouTube's OKRs needed work. The company, around 800 people at the time, was producing hundreds of them each quarter. A team would open a Google Doc and start typing in objectives, and they'd wind up with 30 or 40 for 10 people, and less than half of them would actually get done. Engineers struggle with goal setting in two big ways. They hate crossing off anything they think is a good idea, and they habitually underestimate how long it takes to get things done. I'd lived through this at Product Search, where they'd insist, come on, I'm a smart person. I can surely get more done than that. It took discipline for people to narrow their list to 3 or 4 objectives for their team, but it made a huge difference. Our OKRs became more rigorous. Everybody knew what counted most. After I took responsibility for search and discovery at YouTube, it only made sense to do the same thing there. Then Saler Kamengard turned over day-to-day leadership for the tech side of YouTube to Shishir Mehrotra, and Shishir helped bring focus to the whole company. He used a metaphor called the Big Rocks Theory, which was popularized by Stephen Covey. Say you have some rocks and a bunch of pebbles and some sand, and your goal is to fit as much of everything as you can into a wide-mouth, 1 gallon jar. If you start with the sand, then the pebbles, the jar will run out of room for all of the rocks. But when you start with the rocks, add the pebbles, and save the sand for last, the sand fills the spaces between the rocks. Everything fits. In other words, the most important things need to get done first, or they won't get done at all. But what were YouTube's big rocks? People did their own things and let 1,000 flowers bloom, but no one could identify the top-level OKRs. Now leadership was saying, all of your ideas are wonderful, but could we please identify a few of them as our big rocks for this quarter and for the year? After that, everyone at YouTube knew our top priorities. all of our big rocks would make it into the jar. That was a giant step toward the goal that swallowed the next 4 years of my life. A better metric. YouTube had figured out how to make money, but they still weren't sure how to grow viewership. Fortunately, for the company and me, an engineer in Google Research Group was out in front of us. On a dedicated team named Sybil, Jim McFadden was building a system for selecting Watch Next recommendations, also known as related videos or suggestions. It had tremendous potential to boost our overall views, but were views really what we wanted to boost? As Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella has pointed out, in a world where computing power is nearly limitless, the true scarce commodity is increasingly human attention. When users spend more of their valuable time watching YouTube videos, they must perforce be happier with those videos. It's a virtuous cycle. More viewership, or watch time, begets more advertising, which incentivizes more content creators, which draws more viewership. Our true currency wasn't views or clicks, it was watch time. The logic was undeniable. YouTube needed a new core metric. Watch time and only watch time. In September 2011, I sent a provocative email to my boss and the YouTube leadership team. Subject line, watch time and only watch time. It was a call to rethink how we measured success. All other things being equal, our goal is to increase video watch time. For many folks at Google, it smacked of heresy. Google Search was designed as a switchboard to route you off the site and out to your best destination as quickly as possible. Maximizing watch time was antithetical to its purpose in life. Moreover, watch time would be negative for views, the critical metric for both users and creators. Last but not least, to optimize for watch time would incur a significant money hit, at least at the start. Since YouTube ads were shown exclusively before videos started, fewer starts meant fewer ads. Fewer ads meant less revenue. Though it's a work in progress, YouTube now intersperses some ads mid-video to correspond to its new definition of value. My argument was that Google and YouTube were different animals. To make the dichotomy as stark as possible, I made up a scenario. A user goes to YouTube and types the query, "How do I tie a bow tie?" And we have two videos on the topic. The first one is a minute long and teaches you very quickly and precisely how to tie a bow tie. The second is 10 minutes long and is full of jokes and really entertaining. I'd ask my colleagues, which video should be ranked as our first search result? For those at Google Search, the answer is easy. The first one, of course, if people come to YouTube to tie a bow tie, we surely want to help them tie a bow tie. And I'd say, I want to show them the second video. And the search cohort would protest, why would you do that? These poor people just want to tie their bow ties and get to their event. They were probably thinking, this guy is insane. But my point was that YouTube's mission was fundamentally divergent. It's fine for viewers to learn to tie bow ties if that's all they want. They'll choose the 1 minute manual. But that's not what YouTube was about, not really. Our job was to keep people engaged and hanging out with us. By definition, viewers are happier watching 7 minutes of a 10-minute video, or even 2 minutes of a 10-minute video, than all of a 1-minute video. And when they're happier, we are too. It took 6 months, but I won the argument. On the Ides of March 2012, we launched a watch time optimized version of our recommendation algorithm aimed at improving user engagement and satisfaction. A big round number. In November 2012, at our annual YouTube Leadership Summit in Los Angeles, Shashir gathered a few of us together. He said he was about to announce a big stretch goal to kick off the coming year, 1 billion hours in daily user watch time. There is power in simplicity, and round numbers are simple. He asked us, when can we get this done? What's the time frame? 1 billion hours represented a 10x increase, and we knew it would take years, not months. We thought 2015 was too soon, and 2017 sounded weird. Prime numbers in general sound weird. Just before Shashir took the stage, we settled on the end of 2016, a 4-year OKR with a set of rolling annual objectives and quarterly incremental key results. So the objective was to reach 1 billion hours of watch time on a day by the end of 2016. And the key results were the search team and the main app team and the living room team were going to contribute a certain percentage increase. The gaming team was going to contribute a certain amount of hours per day. And we were going to launch some other experiences like VR to grow from X to Y. Principled stretching. Stretch goals can be crushing if people don't believe they're achievable. That's where the art of framing comes in. Clever manager that he is, Shashir cut our BHAG down to size. While 1 billion daily hours sounded like an awful lot, it represented less than 20% of the world's total television watch time. Introducing that context was helpful in clarifying, at least for me. We weren't gunning to be arbitrarily big. Rather, there was another thing out there way bigger than us, and we were trying to scale up to it. In pursuing our mission over the next 4 years, we weren't 10x absolutists. In fact, we'd commit to some watch time negative decisions for the benefit of our users. For example, we made it a policy to stop recommending clickbaity videos. 3 weeks in, the move proved negative for watch time by 0.5%. We stood by our decision because it was better for the viewer experience, cut down on clickbait, and reflected our principle of growing responsibly. 3 months in, watch time in this group had bounced back and actually increased. Once this content became less accessible, people sought out more satisfying content. Once the billion-hour BHAG was set, however, we never did anything without measuring impact on watch time. If a change might slow our progress, we'd be scrupulous about estimating just how much. Then we build internal consensus before going through with it.
Getting up to speed. Salar Kamangar most enjoys the earlier stages of companies. He likes taking them to the next level. He's really good at that. By 2012, YouTube had grown into a big organization, and Salar decided to move on. The company had split into two factions, business and technology, and needed someone to bring them together. After leading AdWords for a decade, I was used to complex ecosystems. I was eager to take on the challenge of unifying YouTube. When YouTube leadership set the 1 billion hour daily watch time goal, most of our people judged it impossible. They thought it would break the internet. But it seemed to me that such a clear and measurable objective would energize people, and I cheered them on. By February 2014, when I came over, YouTube was nearly a third of the way through the 4-year mega stretch OKR. But while the objective was well planted, it wasn't quite on pace. Watch time growth had dropped significantly below what we needed to make our deadline, a source of stress for all involved. While Google aims for a grade of 0.7, or 70% attainment, on stretch goals, in aggregate, and there are times people totally fail, no team goes into an OKR saying, let's settle for 70% and call it a success. Everybody tries to get to 100%, especially once an objective seems within reach. It's safe to say that no one at YouTube would have been satisfied to reach 700 million daily watch time hours. In all honesty, though I wasn't certain we'd reach the billion hours on time, I thought it would be okay if we missed it by a little bit, as long as everyone stayed united and aligned. I'd seen us miss objectives at Google, and we'd renew our focus and roll them forward. In 2007, when we introduced AdSense to monetize the whole web, the launch was a quarterly OKR. We worked really hard to release it to the actual day, but wound up 2 days late. No harm was done. Maybe the best thing about OKRs is how they track your progress to a target, especially when you're behind schedule. When I ran Google's mid-OKR updates, the point was to figure out how to fix things and get back on track. The updates were opportunities to gather the leadership team and say, okay, I want each of you to name 5 projects you can implement to bring us closer to our goal. We'd extend the OKR and promote positive behavior. So I wasn't super worried about hitting the billion hours before the clock struck 12. Christos Goodrow, the OKR's guardian, had another perspective. The billion daily hours had become his white whale. Not long after I joined the company at our up-to-speed meeting, Christos presented me with a deck of 46 slides. By number 5, he'd made his point loud and clear. We needed to catch up.
I was very concerned. Each year we announced our annual objectives and areas of focus. From 2013 through 2016, the billion-hour OKR headlined the presentation. We also had clear interim milestones to stay on track. When I first met with Susan, I thanked her for keeping our 10X goal. Then I said, by the way, we're way behind. I'm freaked out, and I hope that you're at least a little freaked out. And when you're making decisions about what to prioritize and where to lean, please keep in mind that we are not going to meet this watch time OKR if we don't do something about it.
I had some pressing concerns. One was a rear guard action with Google's machine people to make sure we had the infrastructure to support our goal. It takes a flood of bytes to get YouTube videos from our data centers to the user, way more than what's required for email or social media. The technical term is egress bandwidth. We do everything we can to guarantee in advance that Google will have enough servers to route all those bytes to deliver your cat video to your phone or laptop. After announcing the billion-hour OKR, YouTube's leadership team went on a charm offensive to reserve the bandwidth we'd need through 2016. When I took the reins, Google Server Group asked to renegotiate what must have seemed like an exorbitant spend. I was in a tough spot. I was new, and we were lagging our projected usage. But if we cut back on our machines, I knew it wouldn't be easy to recover. So I kicked the can down the road. I said to those high-powered technical people, let's just stay with the plan for now and meet again in 3 months. I wanted to hang on to our reservations until we knew where things stood. 3 months later, we had more data and more growth and an easier case to make. The billion-hour OKR was an important goal at YouTube, and I wanted to support that goal. But it was so black and white that I feared it could be detrimental if not properly managed. My job was to keep an eye on the gray, the nuances that might get overlooked. Daily watch time is driven by two factors, the average number of daily active viewers, or DAVs, and the average amount of time those viewers spend watching YouTube. YouTube was doing a good job on the second variable, but that was lower hanging fruit. It's easier to expand a relationship than to get a new one started. Our research showed a lot more growth potential in enlarging our user base than in getting existing users to watch twice as much YouTube. We wanted new users, and so did our advertisers.
Mutual support. Whenever you get new leadership, everything's up for review. When Susan took over YouTube, she wasn't obligated to get behind the billion-hour OKR. That was the previous administration's goal. She could have reverted to a views goal or one more oriented towards revenue. Or she could have kept the watch time OKR but added 3 others of equal or greater priority. Had she done any of those things, we would never have reached the billion hours on time. We'd have gotten distracted and never caught up. After Susan arrived, we began putting people's names next to our YouTube company goals with colored bars denoting progress, green, yellow, or red. My name, Christos, was listed with the 1 billion hours at every weekly staff meeting, quarter after quarter, year after year. I personally felt responsible for that OKR. I appreciated the Google creed of setting risky, aggressive goals and making it okay to fail against them. And I knew some good things had already happened. Since declaring the BHAG, my team had significantly improved video search and recommendations. We were the tip of an OKR spear that had raised YouTube's profile and stature throughout Google. The company's morale had never been higher. I'd hear marketing people discussing watch time with real fervor, something I never would have expected. Even so, this OKR was different for the company and for me. Early on, I told Shashir that if we failed to make our 4-year deadline, I'd resign from Google. And I meant it. I know that sounds melodramatic, but that's how I felt. And maybe that intensity of commitment helped me stick with it. By New Year's 2016, the beginning of our gun lab, we were on schedule, but just barely. Then the warm weather doldrums kicked in, with people spending more time outside and watching fewer videos. Would they ever come back? As late as July, our growth rate was lagging our year's end goal. I was nervous enough to ask my team to think about reordering their projects to re-accelerate watch time. In September, folks returned from their summer travels. As old viewers resumed their habits and new ones tuned in, all of our search and recommendations improvements were amplified. Reaching 1 billion hours was a game of inches. Our engineers were hunting for changes that might yield as little as 0.2% more watch time. In 2016 alone, they would find around 150 of those tiny advances. We'd need nearly all of them to reach our objective. By early October, daily watch time was growing well beyond our target rate. That's when I knew we were going to make it. Still, I kept checking our watch time graph every day, 7 days a week, when I was on vacation, when I was sick. And then, one glorious Monday that fall, I checked again and saw that we'd hit 1 billion hours over the weekend. We'd achieved the stretch OKR many thought was impossible and ahead of schedule. The next day, for the first time in more than 3 years, I did not check the graph. Our landmark OKR had some unanticipated consequences. Through the 4-year push to reach the 1 billion hours of daily watch time, our daily views soared in parallel. Stretch OKRs tend to set powerful forces into motion, and you can never be sure where they'll lead. Another big lesson for me was the importance of support from the top. Susan and the rest of YouTube's leadership believed in the goal. They trusted we had chosen the best possible course, and they were happy it was ambitious and clear. But when lots of people in Google Search were openly skeptical about our OKR, the leadership at Google stood up and supported it, giving us the autonomy we needed.
Thinking bigger. Aspirational goals can prompt a reset for the entire organization. In our case, it inspired infrastructure initiatives throughout YouTube. People started saying, if we're going to be that big, maybe we need to redesign our architecture. It became a prod for the whole company to prepare better for the future. Everybody started thinking bigger. Looking back, I doubt we could have reached the goal in 4 years without the process, structure, and clarity of that stretch OKR. In a fast-growing company, it's a challenge to get everybody to align and focus around the same objective. People need a benchmark to know how they're performing against it. They can't just define the right one. The 1 billion hours of daily watch time gave our tech people a North Star. But nothing stays the same. In 2013, the watch time metric was the best way to gauge the quality of the YouTube experience. Now we're looking at other variables, from web-added videos and photos to viewer satisfaction. If you watch 2 videos for 10 minutes apiece, the watch time is the same, but which one makes you happier? The journey to 1 billion hours was long and it involved many steps along the way. Before pivoting to watch time, we used clicks and then views as a way to measure how much users liked a video. The trouble with the clicks-views approach was it sometimes rewarded videos that were clickbait. Watch time represented a big shift for the company because it focused on content that users not only clicked on, but actually watched. This focus allowed us to achieve an important milestone in YouTube's history, and it helped make YouTube a better platform for our users, particularly around genres like music, how-to videos, or entertainment and late-night comedy clips. Around 2015, we shifted beyond watch time to incorporate user satisfaction into the videos we recommended. By surveying users about what content they found satisfying after watching videos, and also incorporating signals such as likes and dislikes, we were able to better measure a user satisfaction with a video. We made this change to ensure that users felt like their time on YouTube was well spent. In 2017, we introduced new features like a breaking news shelf on the homepage, where we focused not on engagement, but on surfacing prominently relevant content from authoritative news sources. Today, we're working more broadly to incorporate other new signals into our recommendations. Some examples would be content authoritativeness and educational value. As our business grows and YouTube's role in society evolves, we will continue to find the right metrics for our services and with them, the right OKRs.
Part 2, The New World of Work. Chapter 15 is about continuous performance management. OKRs, and CFRs. Sheryl Sandberg says, talking can transform minds, which can transform behaviors, which can transform institutions. Annual performance reviews are costly, exhausting, and mostly futile. On average, they swallow 7.5 hours of management time for each direct report. Yet only 12% of HR leaders deem the process highly effective in driving business value. Only 6% think it's worth the time it takes. Distorted recency bias, burdened by stack rankings and bell curves, these end-of-year evaluations can't possibly be fair or well-measured. What business leaders have learned very painfully is that individuals cannot be reduced to numbers. Even Peter Drucker, the champion of well-measured goals, understood the limits of calibration. A manager's first role, Drucker said, is the personal one. It's the relationship with people, the development of mutual confidence, the creation of a community. Or, as Albert Einstein observed, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. To reach goals beyond imagining, people must be managed at a higher level. Our systems for workplace communications cry out for an upgrade. Just as quarterly OKRs have rendered pro forma annual goals obsolete, we need an equivalent tool to revolutionize outdated performance management systems. In short, we need a new HR model for the new world of work. That transformational system, the contemporary alternative to annual reviews, is continuous performance management. And it is implemented with an instrument called CFRs, not OKRs, but CFRs, for conversations, an authentic, richly textured exchange between a manager and contributor, feedback, bidirectional or network communications among peers to evaluate progress and guide future improvement, and recognition, expressing appreciation to deserving individuals for contributions of all sizes. Like OKRs, CFRs champion transparency, accountability, empowerment, and teamwork at all levels of an organization. As stimulants for communication, CFRs ignite OKRs and then boost them into orbit. They're a complete delivery system for measuring what matters. They capture the full richness and power of Andy Grove's innovative system. They give OKRs their human voice. Best of all, these tools, OKRs and CFRs, are mutually reinforcing. Doug Dennerlein is CEO of BetterWorks, a pioneer in bringing OKRs and CFRs to the cloud and smartphone, and in helping hundreds of organizations make these processes their own. Doug says, quote, "It's the marriage between the two. That's the real home run. If a conversation is limited to whether you achieved a goal or not, you lose context. You need continuous performance management to surface the critical questions. Was the goal harder to achieve than you thought when you set it? Was it the right goal in the first place? Is it motivating? Should we double down on the two or three things that really worked for us last quarter? Or is it time to consider a pivot?" You need to elicit those insights from all over the organization. On the other hand, if you don't have goals, what the heck are you talking about? What did you achieve and how? In my experience, people are more likely to feel fulfilled when they have clear and aligned targets. They're not wandering and wondering about their work. They can see how it connects and helps the organization. To hazard another football analogy, let's say the objectives are the goalposts, the targets you're aiming for, and the key results are the incremental yard markers for getting there. To flourish as a group, players and coaches need something more, something vital to any collective endeavor. Those are CFRs, which embody all the interactions that tie the team together from one game to the next. They're the Monday videotape postmortems, the midweek intra-squad meetings, the pre-play huddles, and the end zone celebrations for jobs that are well done. So let's talk about reinventing HR. The good news is a change is in the breeze. 10% of Fortune 500 companies have already ditched the old once-a-year performance review system, and their numbers are growing. Countless smaller startups, less tied to tradition, are doing the same. we're at the point where nearly every HR custom needs to be reimagined. A mobile, agile workforce and a non-hierarchical